going, guys?
Not so good, Fonz. We're not going to make it.
Well, how much more do you need?
Another 15 bucks.
All right, now listen up, girl. One time only. Line right up here, kiss the Fonz for a buck. Now, that's a bargain at any price.
All right, Emmy Award winner Henry Winkler co-stars in the dark comedy television series created by Alec Berg and Bill Hader called Barry, with the new season airing Sunday nights at 9 Central on HBO. And this year marks the 45th anniversary of 70s sitcom Happy Days. And to talk about that journey, Henry Winkler joins us this morning. Welcome back to the show, Henry.
How are you this morning?
Excellent, excellent. Thanks for joining us, man. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you believe that it's been 45 years this year that Happy Days hit the small screen? Pretty unbelievable.
You know what? I can't either. And I mean that in it seems like yesterday. You know, I still talk to so many of the cast members. I just had lunch with Don Most, who played Ralph Mouth. Mm-hmm. I talk to Marion Ross all the time, one of the great women of the 21st century.
Not only is she delightful, but boy, she tells it like it is. There's
she
no holds barred.
Like it is. Yeah. And she always did. Whenever I had a problem, a philosophical problem, something I couldn't solve, I always went to her.
Sure.
On the set.
Yeah, I bet. Mm-hmm. I bet. Very motherly. Very motherly. You know, the show premiered in 74. The original pilot was called New Family in Town. It was taped in 71. It didn't fly, and your character hadn't even been developed yet at that point.
No. You know what? It is, we did it like a little film, so that we shot it all around Paramount lot. We almost never left Paramount lot, except when we did the car races or whatever that was.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't working. We were number 48 of all the shows on the air at the time, which was pretty poor.
Yeah, what was the turning point?
1975, Gary Marshall made a deal with ABC and said, you know what, we're going to shoot it in front of a live audience. I have great success with that, with The Odd Couple. Let's try it like that. And it took off and like a rocket, and it became number one.
I think I remember the episode, actually, because I remember it seemed like out of norm of what we were watching those first couple seasons. It was when you were getting married to a stripper. I think it's what it was.
You know what? I did not remember that.
Yeah, it was getting married to the stripper, because I remember the way they changed the set to do it for a live audience, but in the first couple seasons, the Cunningham house looked a little different, Arnold's looked a little different, and I remember that being the live episode and how crazy people got. I mean, just when you or Ron or somebody walked out on the stage, the screaming that would happen, so different from what we were watching with the laugh track and so forth the first couple of seasons. It was incredible.
It was pretty amazing. It was amazing for us. Here's the thing. Ron Howard had not really done anything in front of a live audience before. And I'm telling you, he is so powerful as a human being. It was like he took it to a duck to water.
Is that right? That's great.
It was seamless. You know, I was amazed. Because, you know, you have to wait for the laugh. You know, at the crest of the laugh is when you start the next line. If you do it too early, you cut the laugh off. The audience gets confused and frustrated. You know, it's very particular, very detailed to work in front of a live audience. He was amazing.
And the rest is really history, because at that point, the show absolutely took off. I think Happy Days, the theme changed, like everything Rock Around the Clock
got
dumped.
The theme changed because of money. You know, Rock Around the Clock was too expensive. So they wrote a theme song that they could then use forevermore.
Gotcha.
And Charlie Fox, who wrote the theme song, has my very same birthday.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. Small fact.
Small fact. And
you
I think
know these things.
Absolutely. And I think also from a perspective of, because I know that
here's another fact.
Yeah, sure.
The food they put down in front of us in Arnold's was horrific.
Was it really?
Inedible.
So was it even from the craft table? Was it just sitting around all day? I mean,
the craft table was already a French five-star restaurant compared to what they put down in front of us.
That's lovely. I'll remember that next time I'm watching you take a bite out of something.
Yeah. Notice I don't take a lot of bites.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know the music thing too. I think the next season of Happy Days finally coming out on DVD. That has been hung up by rights issues. But didn't they use Anson a lot to sing a lot of the songs coming out of the jukebox and so forth?
Well, everybody was a singer but me. Anson sang, Donnie sang, I think they both made an album. Scott Baio sang, he made an album.
Right.
They wanted me to make an album, and I said, gentlemen, I cannot sing, and I will not make an album if I can't sing. They said, it's okay. We'll record one note at a time. And I thought to myself, nah, I don't think so.
And then try to put it together, try to edit it all together.
And they would then edit the notes together. And I thought, this is a bad thing. This is bad.
Yeah.
You know, because if there's such a thing as reincarnation, man, I'm coming back as Bruce Springsteen.
I would hope so.
Oh, yes.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I would hope so. You know, there was something else also I remember in the beginning of the series. The Fonz character did not wear a leather jacket. He wore a windbreaker. What was the windbreaker all about?
They were convinced that I would be associated with crime if I wore leather. So I could do everything but wear leather until Gary Marshall made a deal with ABC. And said, he will only wear leather when we put Fonzie's bike in the scene. And the ABC said, okay. And on his way back to the studio, that was at ABC, which is in Century City, which is a small enclave in L.A. on the way to the beach.
Okay.
That's where ABC was housed at that time. And on his way back to Paramount Lot, he called the writer's room and said, never write another scene without the bike.
And the rest is history there.
And the rest is history, and now it's in the Smithsonian.
Isn't that something? I've seen that. I've seen that at the Smithsonian. That's pretty cool. I mean, you're there with Archie Bunker's chair and Kermit the Frog and all kinds of other great iconic items.
It is amazing, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. Well, your character and the show became such a cultural phenomenon at that time. And, I mean, you went quickly from a supporting player to one of the stars of the show. And I got to assume that the success and visibility came very quickly. Was it overwhelming?
Very quickly.
Was it overwhelming at the time?
You know, it was overwhelming just because more people talked to me than I knew in my life.
Sure.
You know, and... And they stopped me everywhere I went, and I couldn't get over that. I went to Little Rock, Arkansas, to make a personal appearance, and 3,000 people were at the airport at 11:30 at night. And I thought, oh my goodness,
I'm here.
If I walk through this, I'm spoiling somebody's party. And somebody said, the party is for you.
Wow,
that was amazing.
Absolutely was.
Yeah.
Absolutely was.
Yeah.
Now, I know Gary Marshall kept everybody's head on straight during all the success by having you guys play softball, which I think is brilliant because it creates such a team effort. And you played all over the world, but you also played softball right here at Wrigley Field.
We sure did.
Yeah.
And, you know, we got jackets from the team, bats. My father got lost in that baseball stadium. We were supposed to go to the hotel afterwards and spent 2 hours looking for my father, who was walking around chatting with people in the stands.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
It's true.
But you weren't a big player, sports player at the time. I mean, who did you learn from? Like, who taught you how to play and so forth? And you were a pitcher,
well,
I believe,
you know,
right?
What? The team.
Okay.
Ron Howard bought me my first glove. And Anson bought me a bat for my birthday. I don't have good eye-hand coordination, you know, because I am so learning challenged. I never have played ball before, and I learned to pitch. And they were then Walter Von Huene, who was the script consultant. He would help us memorize our lines in between takes, in between scenes. He would teach me to pitch.
Oh, that's cool.
And I then traveled all over the world with the team, and I played for the first time, and I felt wonderful that I was playing a sport.
But isn't that so true, even from any business perspective, to create kind of that team effort and that team environment really helps bond people together?
Oh, without a doubt. We were truly a family.
Yeah.
We would play charades on Saturday night at the director's house, rest in his soul, Jerry Paris, who unfortunately passed away.
Yeah.
But
we,
the cast, would have killed for him.
No, I bet. I bet. He started off, I believe, Jerry was from the Dick Van Dyke Show originally. And then he
was the dentist. He was the next-door neighbor.
Jerry Helper.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about Henry's favorite episodes, working with Ron Howard, his movie career, and so much more, all next on 720 WGN.
Fonzie, it's just a motorcycle.
Just a motorcycle, Mr. C? And I suppose your mother was just a mother.
Like gray sky, hello blue.
Hello blue.
You can't hold me when I hold you.
What an amazing cast and crew, Henry, that you got to work with. Gary Marshall, Jerry Paris, writers like Lowell Gantz, Babalu Mandel, Fred Fox, as well as your co-stars, Ron Howard, Marion Ross, and Tom Bosley.
Tom, I had seen on Broadway before I ever got to California. He won the Tony Award for playing Mayor LaGuardia in Fiorello.
Oh, okay.
And it was a really successful musical at that time. And I had seen it, and then all of a sudden, boom, there I was on the set with him.
Pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible.
Yeah, and there were so many notable guest stars as well. I mean, and when I say guest stars, some of these folks were, you know, it was many before their time where they were big. Tom Hanks, Robin Williams, throwbacks like Frankie Avalon, Cheryl Ladd, John Hart, who was the original Lone Ranger, Buffalo Bob Smith, Hank Aaron. I mean, it was really the who's who guested on the show.
I had my script signed by Hank Aaron.
Is that right? That's great.
Yeah. And Phil Silvers, who at the beginning of television comedy, his daughter played Jenny Piccolo.
Right, that's
right. And he came to visit. Oh, my gosh.
He played her father on the show, too, didn't he?
Yeah, he might have, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the Lone Ranger gave me a silver bullet.
Fact.
I still have the silver bullet.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. There are so many memorable episodes from 11 years and 255 episodes. What were some of those standouts that you just remember and say, wow, that was just an incredible time?
The one that where Chachi was in the ring in a boxing match, and I remember because my daughter was two at the time, and she would come to the audience in the afternoon, the test audience, when we were just working out the jokes.
The run-through. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the run-through. And she would come and watch that. And when the boxer, and I unfortunately I don't remember his name, started going after Chachi, she stood up in the audience and started to yell, "Don't you dare hit Scott! Don't you hit Scott!" I just thought that was amazing.
Absolutely.
The whole everybody just froze.
That's great. That was, I think, at the end of the series, like there was the last season or two or something like that. I remember that episode.
Well, you know, he had to step into Ron's shoes when Ron decided that he was going to become a director.
Director, right?
Yeah,
right. Which leads me to you know, one of his first movies was a movie that you and Michael Keaton starred in, which was Night Shift, which was hysterical, and Shelley Long too.
You know what? I love that movie still. I think it holds up.
Totally.
And Ron said, you can play either role. And I thought, well, Billy Blaze is kind of like the Fonz.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to play Richie.
Yeah. Oh, it was a completely different role. I mean, when people went and saw you there, I'm sure they thought, wow. I mean, that's what, of course, what acting is all about. And you're an absolutely fabulous actor. So seeing something like that in a whole different light.
That, you know what? That's a very nice thing to say.
Oh, absolutely. I mean it all the way.
Thanks.
I loved.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know if it was necessarily the right choice, because it was too much of a shock to the audience who was coming to expect the Fonz.
Yeah, but you know, you got it. But to make it interesting, I think that's exactly what you're doing. Is it would have been something everyone would have expected you to be that exact same role, and how fun would that be? You can see it every week. Something different
right.
is what's a little more exciting, right?
Yes, absolutely. I love that movie so much. You know, it's when I see it now, all these years later, because it came out, and actually they marketed it wrong. The studio sold it to kids, and it was really 18 to 39.
Yeah, definitely.
And it only became a hit when it got on cable.
Well, that's where I saw it, because I was too young to watch it really when it was first on. Because, I mean, there were strippers and prostitutes, and I can't imagine how they marketed this to kids.
Yeah, but they made it. They even made the poster. Yeah. They made it into a cartoon.
Oh, okay. Oh, no, right. It was animated. That's right.
Animated.
Forgot about that
poster.
I forgot about that. Absolutely, absolutely.
And I think it got the. I think it got the award for the worst campaign of the year.
Did it really? But you know what? Cable is a lot where people discover some of these movies. I mean, that's really where some of these things become absolute classics, is because they're played, especially back in the 80s and 90s when cable was still kind of fresh and new. That's where everybody discovered a lot of this stuff.
That's
where people are discovering Happy Days, is watching, you know, The Hub or TV Land or some of the classic TV networks that are out there right now. That's how my kids discovered it.
Yeah, and thank goodness, because, you know, what is amazing is that parents are sharing Happy Days with their children. And they seem to laugh in 2014 the way they did in 1974.
Well, a lot of that is because, I mean, this is a period piece. So, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, jokes that were, you know, when you watch shows that are about the 70s in the 70s or about the 80s in the 80s, things can date very quickly. Being this was an iconic show that was a throwback to a different era.
That's why Gary Marshall did that on purpose. When he made it in the 70s and he said it in the 50s, he did that so that it would be timeless, that you could tell moral stories, and it never seemed like you were being hit on the head. It just seemed like, oh, that's the way they must have lived then, except that all the stories were relevant for the kids watching it when they first saw it.
Well, and there were life lessons too. I remember, I was born in 67, so I was, you know, I was a kid when I was watching the show. It was my favorite show on television at the time, and I remember the library card episode where, you know, I don't know if you guys were asked to do this. You know, the Fonz has such a powerful voice, but let's talk about getting a library card, and the world went and got library cards.
Yeah. That was an amazing, amazing moment. Because when I said one sentence to Richie, and I said, hey, look, you could get a library card for free, and you could meet a girl there. Registration for library cards went up 500%.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Think about the power of that show. You did something else too, and I forgive me, I can't remember exactly the reason, but it was about kids having trouble expressing their feelings or their emotions.
Their emotions.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And you did something where I think Ron Howard was in an accident and it was in the hospital, and it was showing, you know, you as the Fonz showed, you know, your emotions and how to, you know, you can let it out.
Yeah, Gary got a letter from a home up in New York State that housed wayward boys who would not show their emotion. And they said, could you do something? Because they love Happy Days. They love the Fonz. Maybe if you show the Fonz being emotional, that would strike a chord. And that's where the crying over his, you know, over him in the hospital room came from.
Sure. Well, a lot of impact. You know, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of great music. It was a lot of great laughs, but a very impactful show as well. And again, 40 years ago, still blows my mind.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Me too. I'm very proud that I was part of that ensemble. Yeah, so I am living, you better be very careful what you ask for. I'm not kidding. I am a lucky, lucky human being on this earth.
You're having a good time, too.
Yeah, I am.
All right. Henry, thanks so much for spending some time with
us
tonight.
What a pleasure to chat with you.
Same here. All right. Talk soon. It's Dave Player at 720 WGN.
This happens to be a list of the qualifications of a perfect wife. All right. One, good listener.
Yeah, right.
Two, good sense of humor.
Yeah.
Three, no mustache.
No.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, hon. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one.
Dave Player on 720 WGN. As we continue to celebrate 45 years of TV sitcom Happy Days, Anson Williams starred in the 70s sitcom for all 11 seasons as Richie Cunningham's best friend, Patsy Weber. He's also a respected director and producer, and he joins us in studio. Welcome in, Anson.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, so Happy Days turned 45 this year. How did you get the role on this iconic series?
Well, It's a long story, the road on Happy Days. I don't think people realize that there were two pilots.
Yeah, right.
And the first one didn't have a Fonzie.
No.
And didn't have a Ralphie. And didn't have a Tom Bosley.
No.
And didn't have an Aaron Moran. No. It had Marion, Ron, and I.
Harold Gould.
Harold Gould played the father. Yeah. But it was a softer show. It was more like Summer of 42. You know, it was a year before American Graffiti. And they were really desperate in casting the Patsy character. I mean, I was going down to audition the day before fittings and then shooting the next day. That's how tight it was. So I got the call to audition, and I had never really auditioned for a pilot before. So I go, great, I'm in my car on my way down. It's pouring rain, and my car stalls. And back then, they didn't have cell phones, anything.
Right.
You schlepped to a payphone.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I'm like drenched. I'm just drenched.
Yeah.
And I call up the auto club.
Yeah.
Right? Come get me. Well, it's going to be a few hours. We're swamped.
Oh,
so I go, oh, God. So I get back to the car. And I mean, it's like I took a shower. And I'm this old Corvair, and I'm sitting in. So I'm sitting in there, and I thought, oh, God, I didn't call my agent. Well, I'm not walking back out there.
Not to the phone.
To heck. Yeah. So hours later, they come. It was just a loose wire or whatever. They get it done, but it's hours after the audition. And I'm thinking, well, I might as well go home. I mean, they've cast it. It's done.
Yeah.
And something said in my head,
yeah, go get
you
it.
Move forward, boy.
Yeah,
and
it.
Something deep down said, no, they haven't cast it. I don't know why. And so I'm 4 hours late, 3 hours late. I get to the studio. I get in. And I hear this voice. Where the hell you been, Millie Gussie, the casting director?
Okay.
I go. I'm this. I was
Millie.
Broken down.
Okay.
I was broken
Millie.
Down. I was. You know. I couldn't. She goes. Yeah. Lucky. We haven't found a pot. We haven't found Patsy yet. I go. What's a Patsy? She goes. You read this here. Read this. So I remember my friend Howie Schertzman. So I just like used his personality for the character. So I read. She goes. Stay there. Well, P.S. It goes through. By the time I got home, you know, the phone's ringing, and I'd gotten the part.
Wow.
Okay, I'd gotten
pretty
the part.
Awesome. Yeah.
And we do the pilot.
It was in 71. It was a few years before that. It was a new family in town. So it was kind of a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it wasn't even, you know, I think it was 72.
It was 72?
We did the pilot. Yeah,
okay.
It was the year before.
Okay, okay.
So we do the pilot. It goes, oh, you're just terrific. You're great. Oh, my God. This thing's for sure going to sell. For sure going to sell. I'm already like, ha, this is great.
Yeah.
It doesn't sell.
No,
I go back to concerned boyfriend roles. I mean, it was great. Yeah. It was a career. Literally, there'd be a five-page scene. I have five lines.
Yeah.
So, and then I nod a lot. But so anyway, a year later, American Graffiti comes out. And then Ron's even starring in it, right?
Yeah.
American Graffiti comes out. I'm doing the show called Lisa Bright and Dark in San Francisco, this Hallmark Hall of Fame movie. I get a call. They're doing another Happy Days pilot because, you know, American Graffiti's popular. The Broadway show Grease is popular. They want to do another pilot. I go, great. When are we shooting? Well, you're auditioning.
Oh.
What?
Really?
What? What do you mean? I created the character. I don't know. You know, that,
yeah.
You know, he who owns the gold makes the rules.
Yeah.
They go, they think you and Ron might be too old. What? So now we're down there. Now we've got a screen test.
Because how old are you at the time?
22.
Okay. Yeah.
23.
Okay.
Yeah, 23 at the time. So, and, you know, but we looked like babies.
You're the face. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. But it didn't matter anyway. It's just, you know, corporate stuff. So there's like, you know, 15 pairs of people playing Patsy and Richie. You know, it's like pretty intimidating. But I go down there the day before for wardrobe fitting, and Ron's there getting wardrobe fitting, and we're doing it together.
Yeah.
And he goes, Anson, I know a lot about this pilot stuff. I said, I know nothing. He goes, no, listen to me. They only give you 20 minutes. He said, I got a hunch. If we can find the set and rehearse ourselves and make up all this stuff, all this cool stuff, and then act like it's spontaneous when we're shooting the test, we'll get longer time.
Brilliant. Okay.
He's brilliant. So Ron directs us in the scene, and we create all these bits, right? And so next morning we're first up, and Gary Marshall's directing the test, and 20 minutes turned into 2 hours. Oh, I like that. Do this. Oh, that's good. Do this. We started becoming this creative time. And we walk out of there, and you can see all these sullen faces, the other 14 pairs. Yeah. And I'm just smiling going by. But anyway, P.S., we got the part again.
Yeah.
But again, it was moving forward. Ron was smart. We did that extra something. Now, Don Most was actually auditioning for Potsy.
Okay.
But he was so good, they created the role of Ralph for him.
To hang on to it.
Yeah, and then Fonzie was there. You know, a small part. Well,
very
P.S., you saw the magic happen. And Willie, I remember way back when, I had a problem in high school with football, and I didn't think something was fair. And he said, listen, sometimes there's better ways to get there. There's better ways to get there. Be patient. And sure enough, if we'd have taken the first road with the first pilot, it'd have gone in air and failed.
Interesting to say that.
We got a better way to get there. Second pilot, how did we get there? We had a Fonzie character. We had Tom Bosley. We had a Ralph character. Better way to get there, hit show.
But they still burned one of those off on Love American Style. Was that the first pilot or the second pilot?
The first pilot they burned off. Yeah, it wasn't made for Love American Style, but they played it off.
Because
it was a half hour. You know,
never got rid of anything.
Love American Style was 10 minutes, segments, yeah.
Right. Wow. So were you shocked that this finally got picked up, you know, after a couple of years of just kind of sitting there? Was it kind of, you know, or was it kind of like, yes, I was patient, I waited, and now here it is for me?
No, I wasn't patient. But no, it was like, wow, great. But it went on the air so fast, and we worked so hard.
Yeah.
You didn't even have time to digest it.
Yeah.
You know, it was a crazy time of 17-hour days.
And the pace was different. I mean, it was single camera. There was no audience.
No audience.
It was like Summer of 42 kind of watching. It was like watching a movie every
week.
Yeah,
it was. Well, it's more like Graffiti now.
Yeah.
It had a more of a hipper, you know,
it did.
Music tone to it. And But it was totally different and a lot of work.
But I mean, out of the box, it was number 16. The next season, it dropped down to 40, like out of the top
48th.
30. Yeah, it was 48th. And you weren't sure if it was going to be renewed. And I know the answer to this, but tell us what the turning point was.
Well, first of all of us on our own went out and promoted.
You did.
Enough.
On the road, yeah.
Just to keep it on the air, just to get a chance for third season. Fred Silverman happened to have taken over entertainment at ABC. And Jerry Paris and Gary Marshall thought, if we change the show into three camera, because, you know, Jerry directed Dick Van Dyke. Mm-hmm. Gary was doing The Odd Couple. I mean, there were three camera, you know, geniuses.
Yeah.
They said they think they could work the show into a hit by going live audience. And Fred Silverman agreed, but he said it's very important to put Fonzie forward, move him up to the front. And Ron Howard had a yes or no decision on that. And Ron Howard said, absolutely, better for the show. I'll take a back seat. That's going to make the show. And there we are, 48th place, you know, live audience, first show, people are on their feet, crazy, yelling, screaming. Yeah. That year, we went up to the highest rated show in the history of television, became the number one show in the world, and we became the phenomena.
It was cool to see that episode because, I mean, it was using some of the original set pieces. I think you had it. Didn't they have to move the set to another stage so that
you could
actually film all of that?
Well, we had the I Love Lucy stage.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, the second Lucy series, same crew, same cameras.
Wow.
You know, there's even a story about that stage in the book.
And then, you know, then it took off from there, and the rest is history, really.
Yeah, and it's one of those rare moments in time. Here we are 40 years later talking about it. But Gary Marshall was such a teacher, he made sure we wore many hats, so we'd have lots of tools for our lives, for our careers in show business. And that's why I think everyone's still involved in the entertainment business, because we used it, you know, in a very meaningful way. We took it seriously. We didn't. We were in it. We weren't of it. And we were able to learn directing, writing, and be able to continue our lives in the entertainment business.
One, two, three.
Splish, splash, I was taking a bath. Long about a Saturday night.
So we just talked a little bit about how Happy Days got off the ground. And I have to tell you, what a legendary cast that you worked with, and great people. I've had a chance to talk to Henry Winkler. I actually taught a class with him up at Marquette University on the history of television. And I've interviewed Marion Ross. I mean, such great people to work with.
Oh, it was just one of those rare combinations of people. And, you know, and the real, maybe the major reason for the evergreen part of Happy Days is because of the people. There's something about our personalities and our chemistry that is bigger than the page. You know, it's just, it's an it factor that you can't write. And it just happens rarely. But when it does, it's magic. Happy Days crossed over every culture.
Yeah, it does.
They knew nothing about the 50s.
Yeah.
But they related to the characters. There was something that connected with the human race.
Yeah, and it's pretty timeless as well. You wrote in the book, too, about Gary talking to you about baseball in the beginning of the show to see if you were a player. And obviously he had in mind, from a leadership perspective, how to keep people grounded and how to get people to work as a team, maybe kind of outside of their normal element. I thought that was awesome.
Well, Gary is a sports nut.
Yeah.
And honestly, he wanted a softball team so he could play all the major stadiums in pre-game charity games.
That's brilliant.
And we're auditioning, he wants to know, do you play ball?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Did you play ball? Oh, yeah, I was pretty good. I was in, you know, Little League All-Star game. He goes, what position? I go, first. He goes, I'm first. I play first. I said, but I'll show. He goes, how are you an outfielder? Whatever you want, Gary.
Yeah, right.
So he put together a softball team.
Yeah.
And our greatest memories are those games, are those experiences. We played in Germany. We played in Japan.
I was here when you played at Wrigley.
We played at Wrigley.
79.
We played every major stadium. Yeah. I mean, and it really did make us closer.
Henry didn't play.
Henry did play.
But he didn't at first.
At first, no.
You guys taught him how to play.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Don could have been a professional. Don Most. Ron was great.
Right?
Yeah. I was pretty good. And we had a great, we had some of the crew were amazing. They came with us.
What was the turn? What was the point for you, Anson, where you knew the show was huge? Like, what was that moment that you said, "Holy cow, this is big"?
Well, there were a couple of moments. I mean, from the get go, it was big with the teenage crowd, and that was just mind blowing. I mean, we had no idea till the first personal appearance.
I had an Aaron Moran poster in my room, I'm pretty sure.
they teach you how to act and your craft.
Yeah.
There should be a class on how to deal with fame.
Yeah,
how do you deal with that kind of fame?
Right.
60 million people a week? Up to 68 million people?
Yeah.
You know, and Henry Winkler was the number one star in the world.
Yeah, but when you guys just walked out on stage, the audience was screaming.
Yeah.
Before he even spoke, that's how hot that show
was.
Yeah,
it was. It became apparent where you're everywhere.
Yeah.
And everybody knows you and all that. But at the same time, all of us lived a life to kind of, actually back then, the paparazzi and all that, they weren't as, they didn't cross the line very much. Uh-uh. They didn't go where you lived. They didn't, you know, so basically if you went to them, it was, you know, you had to deal with it, and it's fine. But they didn't come to you. So you could actually kind of create a life for yourself, as popular as it was.
Sure.
These days, boy, I don't know. It would be really difficult to have that privacy.
That fame isn't as big as it was back then, because there was only three channels.
Right.
And so, you know, the exposure that you had was so different. Now, you also talked about in the book, in another inspirational moment from Willie, you know, you wanted to kind of expand what you were doing with the show even. And you went to Gary and said, you know, I sing.
Oh, when I was 15, that first year I was working there at Leonard's department store, we're unpacking refrigerators in the appliance department, and way back. And the big deal was you had these refrigerators, and when you opened the little freezer in them, there was no ice.
Okay.
Your food was without chopping away at rice and all that.
Yeah.
So we're unpacking him, and I tell Willie, freeze your food, not your freezer. And he goes, that's good, boy. You got the gift of words. You know, you find opportunity. Yeah. You know, you got that.
That's some good advertising stuff there.
Yeah, he said, you got the gift. You know how to sell. He said, you use that proper. Don't use it for bad. You use it for good. You good boy. And 2 days later, there's a banner across the appliance, section.
Yeah.
Freeze your food, not your freezer. And I felt so great. I'm good at something. Yeah. And they sold a bunch of refrigerators. So that was the beginning of me looking for opportunities. It was kind of my entrepreneurial beginning. And so while we're doing Happy Days, we didn't get paid like stars do today. Nowhere near.
Right.
So I'm looking for opportunity, and it hits me. You know, David Cassidy's singing on the Partridge Family. He's got this record deal.
You had a similar record, same label.
Right. Well, yeah. What happened? Yeah. And then the Brady Bunch, they're singing. So I said, let's get a band on the show. So I find Gary, and Gary's telling me, I don't have time right now. I'm busy. I go, no, you got to listen to me. He goes, well, walk with me. What? Quick. So I had 60 seconds. It changed my life. I said, you got girls. You got cars. You need a band on Happy Days. You know, remember, I sing, and we can have this band, and Richie could be in it, and Ralphie could be in it.
Well, music was a big part of the show anyway.
We have a band. We can use it. It'd be great for the show. He goes, oh, a band, yeah. I used to be a drummer. Yeah, I could. That's a good idea. He said, yeah, there's a show coming up, a fraternity party, and the band can play there. Go to Bobby, and you pick a song. I like that. I'm going, it just changed my life.
Yeah.
60
right.
seconds.
Yeah.
Then he stops and turns back to me. But you're singing to a bulldog. I go, why? He said, if you're good, I get laughs. If you're bad, I get laughs. You're singing to a bulldog. So there I am, singing. I'm all shook up to a bulldog.
Yeah.
But singing to a bulldog, it was much more than...
Metaphorical for you.
Yeah, it was much more than just singing that one song. It opened up a music career on the show. I got signed to the same label as David Cassidy.
Right, right.
I started doing concerts all over the country.
What's the thing? After you tape on Fridays, you were on a plane.
I was on a plane doing a concert somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like I said earlier, jumping the shark is a precise moment when success fails. Singing to bulldogs is a precise moment when you start to climb. And that was the beginning of my climb. Real climb in life.
Yeah.
And I thought it was apropos for the title.
But I mean, Vegas, Atlantic City, I mean, you were really out there.
The road. It took years to get there.
Still.
I was a teeny bopper.
Yeah.
And finally got my opportunity in the adult rooms. But after a while, I even knew then it was over. Done. It's getting to be too wide a river. Time to go behind the camera. I felt it so strongly. And that's when I went back as a producer, as a director.
Sure.
And I got off the stage.
Yeah, yeah.
It was time.
Gotcha. But, you know, again, during the popularity of the show, you had folks like John Lennon, who was a fan of the show, on the set, which you talk about in the book. I don't want to give it away because there's a great story there. But you had like...
Elvis Presley.
Yeah, Elvis.
I met him in a... it's an Elvis Presley story. Yeah. If you like Elvis Presley...
Great story in the book.
This is a story never told before.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say it here.
No, I don't. I want to
never
read
told
it.
Before. It will surprise you.
And then some of the people, you know, that were on set: Tom Hanks, throwbacks like Frankie Avalon, Cheryl Ladd, John Hart, the original Lone Ranger, Buffalo Bob Smith, Hank Aaron. And then there was,
and who else visited us on the set? Ringo Starr.
Ringo. You even had Ringo on there.
But you didn't put Pat O'Brien.
Pat O'Brien with you there too.
he played
a
part.
Right. He did. He
played, Danny Thomas.
He played. Who played Howard's father? Was it Danny Thomas?
Yeah. Oh, no.
Or was that Pat O'Brien?
I think Pat O'Brien. Pat O'Brien. Yeah, that was amazing.
But there was one episode, and I do want you to share a little bit of this story, about Robin Williams. And he wasn't the first guy chosen to play Mork. You guys saw the script for this Mork episode. You were all pretty like, what is this?
The script, you know, Gary and his son, Scotty, who was 10 at the time, saw Star Wars. And Scotty asked his dad to do a Martian episode.
Yeah.
You know, and his family.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a... worst script ever. I mean, we were so proud of the material we would get.
Absolutely.
This was like horrible.
Yeah.
And just anyway, we couldn't believe we were doing this thing. So they hired some actor, and Monday we're rehearsing, Tuesday we're rehearsing, Wednesday we're rehearsing. It's horrid. Thursday's camera blocking day. It's mechanical. And Friday you're shooting it with an audience.
Yeah.
After a quick run through.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Wednesday's the last really rehearsal. That night, the actor quits. And I didn't blame him. He looked terrible. He quits.
Yeah.
Gary comes down to the set and says, anybody know a funny Martian? Al Monero says, there's this funny guy in my Harvey Lembeck improvisational class, Robin Williams. And then Ronnie Hallen, who was Gary's sister, says, oh, yeah, here he's funny. All right, bring him down. So the next morning, it's camera blocking day. There's never a writer on the set. It is just mechanics. I'm in a little later because I'm not in the first few scenes. I get on the set. You can hear a pin drop. There's every writer.
Yeah.
Writing like crazy. Jerry Paris comes up to me. He's a genius. What?
Yeah.
And I watch this Robin Williams creating the whole character, improving the entire script. And the writers are desperately writing down this genius.
Yeah.
Nanu, standing on his head, the whole enchilada.
Yeah.
That was that was Thursday. By Friday night, it was one of the best shows in the history of television.
Yeah.
The audience is going crazy.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. Would Robin have ever had the opportunity to be all he could be in any other part? He would never be 100% if he had to play anything he wasn't. He had this platform to be the God-given gift he is of the world.
Even when I've watched that episode, I've noticed all of you almost like watching him.
Oh.
It's very noticeable that you were all kind of like in awe a little bit of what was going on.
I've never worked with a performer like that. And the kindest, gentlest, wonderful human being on earth.
Great to hear. And I remember when I lived in Minneapolis for a few years, there was a restaurant that opened up in one of the malls called Big L's. Really great food. I knew you were associated with it, and I also knew it was one of those life lessons for you as well.
Yeah, well, I was always entrepreneurial, always look for opportunity. And with Happy Days, I was thinking back then, wouldn't it be great to have Happy Days cafes? You know, like 50 restaurants. I know nothing about food.
Yeah.
And but I kind of created this concept.
Yeah.
And Al Molinaro came on board with me, who actually owned a collection agency, believe it or not. And he knew something about business. And I had a friend who knew someone at Coca-Cola. And I get if they liked your concept, they would finance free performance if you use Coke when you open.
So we
got this whole performer, and they brought in like one of the world's leading experts on fast food. He, in fact, owned 31 Hardee's, like just had this whole empire going in fast food.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes in and starts working with us, and finally says, you know, guys, this is so good. Forget investors. And he says, forget Happy Days. Let's call it Big Al's, because then you don't have to pay Happy Days, licensing or anything.
Yeah.
So let's just us do it. It's too good. I'll come in with you guys. Wow, we got the best guy in the world right here in Al and I. So sure enough, we throw in the money, and he puts the first one up in Overland Park, Kansas. Because in Overland Park Mall, because that's where his offices were.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, bam, huge, huge hit. Comes back to us, guys, I got the bank to back us for, we don't have to put in a dime. They're going to back us for 9 more. Whoa, man.
Yeah.
Great. Now, Al and I know nothing about the restaurant business at the time. We don't know what we're getting into, but we know, oh my God, he's so
business
big.
Business is a learning experience all the way around, my friend. I understand.
Oh, but this guy's, how could we lose? And Willie used to say, look too perfect, talk too perfect, you look inside, boy. You look inside, boy. Well, that lesson came like a little late, later. Okay. Anyway, now we have 10 restaurants. Boom, bang, bang, huge hit. Now, no money's coming to us because the guy's saying, oh, we're putting the money back in.
Right.
Then he goes, guys, got this, let's franchise. Bam, 10 franchises, 20 restaurants in like just over a year. What? I go, hey, I'm a restaurant. We got 20 restaurants, not a dime.
Yeah.
And guess what? And it's going, and it's going. And we just show up and smile.
Great food, by the way. I remember.
Yeah.
It was great food.
It's great food. And then one day we get this little thing in the mail. It's a bankrupt notice from that first partner who happened to be sociopathic, alcoholic, prescription drug addict.
Oh, boy.
Gambleaholic, and was taking all the money out to feed his other situation.
To fund himself.
So all of a sudden, guess who's responsible with all the mall leases and everything, and the bank and everything? Al and myself.
Yeah.
You want to talk about a PhD in business?
Yeah, that was it.
We ended up losing everything we put in it. But we didn't lose our houses, thank God. Someone came in. We were able to like sublease. And,
Right.
It was a lesson in life entrepreneurially. Never, ever go into a business that you don't know about. And if someone looks too perfect, if someone talks too perfect,
yeah,
you look inside, boy. Yeah. You look inside.
Yeah. But I mean, you've had a ton of successful businesses beyond that as well. But the thing is, you've never been afraid of trying something new and reaching that. And that's, again, you know, from your conversations with Willie. And outside of directing, I want to get to that a little bit, you've also launched Star Maker Products some years ago. Explain to us what that is all about.
Well, it started when I was directing Melrose Place.
Yeah.
And, again, always look for opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
Even Gary Marshall said, you know, everyone comes to these sets. The world is just, he says, don't get in the way of yourself. Interesting, because Willie said the same thing. He even saw your entrepreneurial Anson.
Yeah.
Be open for opportunity. So I'm on the Merrill set, and the actresses are raving about the skin treatment they had in the trailer. Huh? They never talk about that. So I went in and I met my future business partner, Joanna Cannell, who was a top makeup artist, but she also created these skin treatments for in-trailer stuff that was really one of a kind. So she tells me it's used on all these shows, on the most famous faces in the world every day. I go, I mean, these are the working products? She goes, oh, yeah. And she did it in bulk. It wasn't mass-produced. I'm thinking, oh, my, what a business. So I created Star Maker Products. Went into business with her, and we started with beauty products. You're as important as any movie star. You deserve the same, same wonderful treatments they use every day before going in front of the camera's critical eye. So we started a company, had already had sales to like the makeup companies that sell to the industry. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up being on QVC for 10 years.
Yeah, right.
And then that expanded to other kinds of products. We just sold a cookbook to QVC called 100 Calorie Chef. I mean, it's a real entrepreneurial experience, which will be under Star Maker. I just made a deal with my uncle, Dr. Heimlich.
Yeah.
We're going to do a line called Heimlich Health, Live Long. And the first product will save more lives than the Heimlich Maneuver. So we're really diversified into so many areas of product. And I love product. It's the same kind of creative juices. And, and I love beating the big guys.
Sure.
I love beating the big guys. And but at the same time, commerce is a huge responsibility and also huge education, because as you know, it's not fun out there.
No,
and it's not
competitive.
It's not right a lot of the times.
Yeah,
so you got to deal with that. And if you can like stomach that and get through and like not take things personally, you can do pretty well in business.
Well, and then on top of all this, Anson, you've been directing for years. Was it an ABC After School Special? Was that one of the first?
Yeah, it's one I co-wrote the story.
Okay,
and I had already produced for a while. And Ron even said, you know, you should really direct, because producing is kind of cold. You're not really involved in the set.
Mm-hmm.
But when he said, oh, you should direct, I'm thinking, great, a third career. So I had an after school special, wonderful little script called No Greater Gift, which is about organ donorship. And ABC gave me the opportunity to hire myself. And that was my first opportunity to direct. And then I actually co-wrote a script about the youngest mayor in the history of the United States called Lone Star Kid with James Earl Jones, which was the second directorial assignment. I had to hire myself.
Yeah.
But it shows you make your own road. You move forward, boy. The third opportunity, I was actually hired. It was for The Drug Nut for CBS. It was a special. And from there, I was able to start a directing career. And I've directed well over 300 hours of television.
I know. I'm looking at Melrose Place, Beverly Hills 90210, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Charmed, Seventh Heaven, Xena, Diagnosis Murder, L.A. Law, recently The Secret Life of the American Teenager.
5 years on that.
Yeah. Like, you know, what is the experience for you directing compared to acting for you? Do you have a preference over one over the other?
Oh, absolutely directing.
Okay.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's so funny. Gary would say, I don't think he was kidding, he would say, you got to wear a lot of hats.
That's true.
You know, you're not going to be actors all your life, especially you, Anson.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I went, I'm about acted out here.
But that's also great for business, too, because when you're an entrepreneur, you're forced to wear a lot of those hats. And it's good to do that because you get to learn all aspects of your own business.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and the greatest lesson, actually came. Did you read the story about when I briefed President Reagan?
Yeah.
And did you read the one where I was in the Oval Office with Ron? You got to hear this. By ourselves in the Oval Office. And there's that little plaque.
Yeah.
And it was the same exact message that was years earlier in the janitorial office. Here's the leader of the free world being so influenced by this Irish saying, and this janitor being equally influenced by this Irish saying. It was kind of amazing, that combination. But basically, you know, any mountain could be climbed, anything accomplished, as long as you don't care who gets the credit.
Thanks for hanging out with us for so long tonight.
So much fun.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
It was great. Thanks for sharing those stories.
You bet.
All right. Have fun when you're in town.
I will.
All right. Much more ahead at 720 WGN.
Dad, there are plenty of ways that we can help out, even if you don't want us to get jobs.
What ways? Name one way.
Well, we could, there are just all kinds of ways.
All right. Come on, Marion. Let's hear it.
Well, tell him, Mom.
There's nothing. Now it's going to cost me $20 to clean the carpets.
I'll clean it for $10.
Never mind. I don't clean it. Now, Howard, there's just all kinds of ways we could take in a boarder.
Another mouth to feed, Marion.
No, we don't have to feed him.
Oh, great. We'll have a dead body on the staircase.
Wait a minute. The boarder doesn't have to eat with us. He doesn't have to live with us.
No, he could stay in a motel. I don't think he'll pay us much, though, Marion.
Sunday, Monday, happy days.
All the harebrained, irresponsible
things. Harebrained?
I've got to be in a meeting in a half an hour, and I don't have any dinner, and I've got a limp fest.
Marion, do this. Marion, do that. You want your dinner? I'll get your dinner. You got it. I'll get your dinner. $1,000. I can do it with my eyes closed. He is your salad, your vegetable, your meat. Live it up!
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So before she was affectionately known to millions as Mrs. C on TV's Happy Days, Marion Ross began her career as a Paramount starlet who went on to appear in nearly every major TV series of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And soon came that fateful phone call from producer Gary Marshall that made her an overnight success and changed her life. In Marion's book, My Days, Happy and Otherwise, Marion's story is one of inspiration, persistence, and gratitude. And to share that journey with us, Marion Ross joins us once again tonight. Marion, how are you?
Well, I am so well. Isn't that extraordinary? I think that's my Midwest, being raised in the Midwest.
I think it is. Very grounded, you are.
Yeah. Well, and we had those tough winters,
you know,
Minnesota, in Albert Lee, Minnesota.
You did. You absolutely did. Well, I got to tell you, I really love this book, Marion. I knew, you know, as a fan and a friend about your career, but not so much about, you know, personally and growing up and so forth. And the book is beautifully and honestly told.
Well, you know, because my brother Gordon was a little crippled boy. He was born with a very bad leg, and they had to take his leg off below the knee when he was 16. So I think a great deal contributes because of him. In fact, I told him that one time when I was all grown up and successful. I said, "I owe everything to you. If it weren't for you, I wouldn't be me. I wouldn't be what I turned out to be." And he said, he didn't see it that way. But I said, no, because I was so strong and healthy, and I had to make up for, I felt, a lot of what he was missing, you know?
Wow, that's very cool. And I know you also kind of credit your son with putting this book together, too, because, you know, I've heard you tell stories, and I always kind of thought in my mind, gosh, why hasn't she written a book yet? But your son kind of encouraged you to put it all together, right?
Yeah, I didn't want to write a book. No. And Jim said, no, Mother. In fact, I'm bringing you this man who's coming to the house. He's great. And I said, really? Yeah, so that'll be swell. And lo and behold, David Laurel, he would get me talking. You know, he'd get me talking, had this tape recorder. Because if you had asked me to sit down and write a book,
That's tough.
I'm not a writer.
Yeah.
I'm not a writer.
Yeah.
You know?
But you can tell great stories. And I know you start this book with really talking about your childhood. And you can honestly say you really did have a pretty happy childhood growing up.
Well, I did, didn't I? I didn't know that, you know?
Yeah.
But I had such... First of all, I'm the second little girl. I'm the middle child. Mm-hmm. Are you a middle child?
I'm the
oldest. You a middle child?
Yeah, I'm the oldest out of two.
You're the oldest.
Yeah.
I see. So I sometimes being the middle child, second little girl, I had to work really hard to get, and then a crippled brother, to get any attention at all.
Yeah, yeah.
I had to be so damn cute, you know?
Yeah. Well, and you were always seeking, and I read this, you were always seeking your dad's attention, right?
I know.
Yeah.
I was aware.
Yeah.
At a very young age that people were watching me, then I'd get cuter than ever.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's something that really inspired you pretty young, that you wanted to get kind of into this business.
Because I wanted attention. And yet I'm a very modest person, but I still wanted attention, if you don't mind. If you don't mind, it would be like, look at me.
Yeah.
Will you look at me?
Yeah, yeah.
I will kill myself up on that stage if you will just watch me.
Yeah.
It's so pathetic. I thought, it's so pathetic. I thought, if I could outgrow that need.
Well, you know,
I never did.
My daughter's a middle child, and I know that's exactly how she feels sometimes. She really has to wrangle us in to get her attention. She's got a much older brother. She's got a much younger brother. And so that kind of, so I think I get what you're saying there. And I know when you were younger, too, you didn't really have a TV in the house, but you were very entertained by theater magazines, movie magazines, radio and theater specifically. But as a young girl in Minnesota, acting was something, and as you said, was something you were always thinking about doing.
Oh, yes. But it was the movie. We went to the movies.
Yeah.
But one of the first books, I don't know if you are familiar with Noel Coward. Some people aren't.
Okay.
No. Oh, it's a great English playwright.
Yeah.
Song and dance man. It's fabulous. So one of the first books I would read when I went to the library was his autobiography. And he was like, in England, and he was like 6 or 7 years old, starting in show business. I was already 13, 14. So I thought, I've got to get going.
Wow, that's awesome. That provided some good inspiration, because I know you also, you know, spent a lot of time in the library too, talking about reading Who's Who's books and trying to understand how people got from where they started to where they were,
right?
Because you wanted that kick to know what you needed to do to get to that next level.
Yeah. Now all of a sudden they're famous. Well, what happened?
I love that. I love that.
I love that you've actually read the book.
I did.
My friend. That's wonderful.
I did. Absolutely. Well, I was going to say, you were in the seventh grade production of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. And as you said, your family did move around a lot, and you didn't always find the place that you were living, the atmosphere, that appealing. But you would always find refuge in the movie theater.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I would read autobiographies of actors.
Yeah,
but movies, of course, they only change the movie like every 2 weeks.
Right.
So that movie, I would cherish it so much and play it over and over in my head. You know, it was wonderful, wonderful. Now we are inundated with entertainment,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we are, aren't we? Yeah, there's just too much to choose from.
Too much.
Yeah.
It was terribly special. And the movie magazines, the movie stars in those days, we don't have that anymore,
no,
do we?
No, not that. Maybe on the Oscar night, but not the glamour that really existed back in the day. No.
Yeah. And if you look at those beautiful photographs of the stars, there wasn't a mark that shouldn't be there. It was all retouched. They were perfection. They were gods. You know?
Yeah, they absolutely were back then.
And you know, what's interesting in my book is that I got to work with I have a picture with Clark Gable. I have a picture with Cary Grant. I thought the pictures were great in that book.
It really kind of told the story of what you were doing, because I was looking at this. You know, you obviously went to study drama at the MacPhail Center of the Arts. You went to San Diego University, and you got married. You moved to Hollywood early on, you know, as you were trying to make it big there in Hollywood, and you eventually got a studio contract at Paramount. You know, you dealt with some struggles, you know, with your husband at the time and alcohol, and you know, having a drink and smoking in the 50s wasn't that uncommon, but this was probably a little over the top.
Oh, no, everybody's smoking.
Yeah.
And because I come from a Scotch Presbyterian father, that was very little drinking, so I wasn't drinking. I didn't think that was going to be a problem for anybody.
Right.
Well, so I found out, didn't I?
Yeah. You did. Yeah, you did. But, you know, you still, you know, with that said, you still forged forward. You were talking about some of the icons that you worked with, along with Ginger Rogers, William Holden, you know.
Yeah.
And you played an Irish maid very early on. And I love this because, you know, you think about the Brooklyn Bridge days. You played an Irish maid on Life
with
Father.
I like doing accents.
Yeah.
I love, so I could do an Irish accent. And I Life with Father, I love that. We did it live at CBS.
Yeah, right.
So with Leon Ames and Lorraine Tuttle live. You know, no mistakes. There it was. So I was always I would love to imitate the way people talked.
Yeah.
If I listened. In fact, I would, when I was like in the third grade, there was a girl that, you know, she had the really cutest small little way of speaking. She just, it was so cute, and I thought, so immediately I imitated that, and the next thing I know, we were both sent to a remedial speech class.
Oh, you know? That's awesome. That's great.
So I snapped out of it right away, but she's there to this day, I suppose.
Yeah, that's cool. No, that's cool. And that was very early television, too. I mean, and I was reading this at Life with Father, even though it was broadcast in black and white, they actually kind of broadcast it in color, but no one had a color TV back then.
Oh, I guess. Yeah. When you get to be as old as I am, it's like this industry. In fact, when I was at Paramount, it was so, and I was 22 years old, 23, under contract to Paramount. Everybody, all the big stars were there on the lot.
That's crazy.
I mean, at lunchtime, Marlene Dietrich would come swooping into the commissary.
Wow.
C.B. DeMille was in this little alcove around the corner. I mean, it was all happening. Edith Head was head of the wardrobe department. And you would go up there, and Edith Head would pick out something for you to wear.
Wow.
You know? And so it was thrilling.
Yeah, thrilling back then. Absolutely. And you did your share of not only movies under contract, but you also did a ton of television. I was looking at this. Donna Reed, Burns and Allen, Father Knows Best. The Glenn Miller Story, you played a mail order bride in an episode of Rawhide. The Fugitive, the Outer Limits, Operation Petticoat with Cary Grant and Tony Curtis, the original Hawaii Five-O, the Brady Bunch. But like other young actors and actresses, you had a list of both struggles and successes, right?
Absolutely. It's not, I hope everybody knows, it's not an easy business. Not easy, children.
No.
You know?
No.
And
no.
I would watch some of these actresses making time, you know, and getting ahead of me. And I would think, but I was so well brought up. I was so careful with myself.
Sure.
So that's why it took me a long time to really get established. I was like, I was in my early 50s with Happy Days, you know?
That's crazy.
Because I was so careful with my life.
Sure. Sure. Well, you know, and then the late 60s, you got divorced. Now you've got kids. You got finances. You know, you got a home to pay for. And you essentially kind of had to start over. And I know you had a friendship with Sandra Gould, who was Mrs. Kravitz from Bewitched.
Yes.
And she kind of told you about this pilot that was happening. And it was the new family in town, which was a prelude to Happy Days, of course.
Yes. On Love American Style, it was known as. Yeah, so I owe her a great deal, and she had me come over for dinner and the casting woman, and simple as that.
Wow. You know? Wow, amazing how that happens.
But, you know, when I look back at my life, I was helped. I was constantly being helped by people.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, yes, good friends, good friends, and great family too. And you know, it was really a dream come true because you know the 1950s were pretty popular with American Graffiti and the theatrical play Grease, and ABC picked up this show with a slightly modified cast from the original pilot. And then you had Ronnie Howard and Henry Winkler, the late Tom Bosley. What an amazing experience that must have been to get that role.
Well, it was. Of course, we had no idea that it was going to turn into this phenomenal success. It was only after I think we'd been on like a year and a half, and then finally the young producer called us all in. And he said, "You've all got to cooperate because we have a hit on our hands."
And you went live in front of a live audience because you were taping that show a little bit more as a one camera kind of show with a laugh track, and now you're going in front of a live audience when the show really took off. But I think about this now. You mentioned earlier about how much entertainment there is out there to watch, but at that time there were 25 million people every week watching that show.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now you see the ratings. You get a 5 or something. We had 22. We always got everybody was watching Happy Days, and then they would go to school and talk about the show.
Yeah.
The night before.
Yeah, it's all water cooler.
You're a wonderful interviewer. Oh. Young man.
Well, thank you, Marian. Thank you, dear. Thank you. Well, and I was looking at this: 11 seasons, 254 episodes. You know, it was an iconic show. Time and time again, you've been voted one of TV's favorite moms. That's got to be a very cool thing.
It's a very comfortable feeling. No matter where I go, there is somebody that will come up to me and say something so nice to me. I'm very appreciative of all of that. Yeah.
Sure. Ron Howard wrote the foreword to your book, which I found apropos because in this book, you know, you talk about the early days in your life. I love the way this book kind of flows. And you talk about the people who were special in your life almost by chapter. And it's kind of a Q&A that goes through people talking about their experiences with you. So you get Henry Winkler, you get Donnie Most, you get Anson Williams, Scott Baio, and of course, your children. I thought that was very well very well done, and people
and my personal assistant too.
Yeah, Gwen.
She wrote a chapter. Gwen.
Yeah, Gwen.
So it's a it's fun, and now it's coming out. So I can move on, right? I think I can enjoy my retirement.
Yes, you absolutely. Yeah, and I know that you. But you know, before you did all that, you did Brooklyn Bridge. You were Drew Carey's mom on the Drew Carey Show, Nurse Jackie, Grey's Anatomy, The Middle.
Oh God!
Right. I mean, you know, you deserve to take a little respite now and enjoy yourself without having to go on one more audition, right?
Absolutely, and it's funny. That you do get satisfied, and I'm very willing to quit. You know, very willing. I don't mind one bit. And so somebody will say, "Oh, look at what one of your pals is doing." I'll say, "Good, good for her."
I love that. Go get them. Oh, that's fantastic. But you know, again, you know, and you also touch upon, and I don't want to be remiss in mentioning this, but of course, you talk about one of the loves of your life, Paul, who passed away back in 2011.
Yeah. My darling, Paul Michael. Yeah.
And what a special relationship that you had, and it's a really touching piece of this book.
Yeah, and you'll see pictures of Paul in the book too. So
it's a good life now. Paul is gone, and but I'm enjoying my family and just having a good time.
Well, we've only touched upon a few of the stories in Marion Ross's new book. It's called My Days Happy and Otherwise, available on Amazon and your local bookseller. And if you'd like to look back at the iconic 70s sitcom about the 50s Happy Days, the first six seasons are all available on DVD as well. Marion, you know, you were one of my first interviews 6 or 7 years ago, and I have to say it is always a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you so much. I love talking to you, honey. It's just wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks so much. All right, bye-bye now. It's 720 WGN.